Okay. Hi, everyone. Thanks. My name is Angela Machiavelli. I'm a senior in Leverett House, and I just wanted to make an announcement for an ethnic studies at Harvard study break tomorrow at Mather JCR at 9 p.m. And there will be free Indian food and other good things to eat. So if you want to learn more about ethnic studies at Harvard and how you can work it into whatever you're concentrating in, et cetera, please show up.
Hi, good morning, welcome. Good to see you here, though you know, initially I was worried that it would be difficult being away, not seeing you for almost 2 weeks, but it turned out that I saw many of you in Mexico. It was good to see you there. and I'm glad you're applying what you learn in positive psychology. So, the topic today, perfectionism. Out of everything that I teach, this is the closest topic to my heart, because in many ways it describes my journey toward becoming happier. The journey from being a perfectionist, a consummate perfectionist, a near-perfect perfectionist, and becoming more and more toward pursuing excellence. Let me tell you a little bit about the things that I went through, my journey, some of it which I elaborate on in the question of happiness. But I want to take it a step further. So I started playing squash at the age of 11. This was after a long and illustrious and successful career as a basketball player. I switched, for various reasons which I would not like to go into at this point, to squash. And very quickly I realized that this was the sport for me. By the age of 12, I was playing 3 hours a day. By the age of 14, I was getting up at 5 a.m. every morning, going for a run, then going to the squash courts, doing a solo routine. No one else was up at that time to play with. Going to school, after school straight to the squash courts, doing a routine with my coach, playing a few matches, going home, doing my homework, and going to bed by 9 p.m. to wake up at 5 a.m. the next morning. This was my routine throughout high school. It was difficult, you know, doing court sprints especially, rigorous, tough, but the most difficult part of it was the emotional part. What I experienced was a constant knot in my stomach, being constantly stressed. I was stressed every time during practice, lest it not be a perfect practice, and usually it wasn't. Highest levels of stress I experienced before matches, especially important matches. Very often when I would get to a final of a tournament, played well all the way up to the final, when I got to the final, I would choke. I would get so nervous, so anxious, that I wasn't able to play well or play at all at times. But I knew that it was all worth it. It was all worth it because ultimately, once I achieved my goals, all the pain would pay off. All the hardship would pay off. Then I would be happy. Then I would no longer be anxious or nervous. Then I would have made it. In 1986, I reached the final of the Israeli National Championships. For me, winning that title was my dream, my childhood dream. That's when I thought I would be happy. 1986, I reached the final and lost. I was devastated. But as we know from Gilbert's effective forecasting studies, I recovered and I started training again for the next year. In 1987, I reached the final again and played the same player in the final, and this time I won. I was ecstatic, happier than I'd ever imagined myself being. Finally, I was there. I made it. The knot in my stomach was gone. The stress was gone. I felt supremely serene, joyous, happy for 4 hours. And the knot returned. Initially, I was baffled. I didn't understand what it was all about. How could it be? My dream came true, and I was still unhappy, still had this knot persisting, not willing to go away. Why? And then I thought, it must be because I haven't won the world championship yet. And immediately I set the next goal, which was to win the World Squash Championship. I graduated from high school and then had 2 years off before going into the army. And I took off to London. London, the center of world squash. There I joined a club in Ealing Broadway, a club called Stripes. I joined it because Janshir Khan, the Pakistani world champion, was training there. I would go to the club early in the morning after my morning run and hang out there, do my solo practice, wait for Janshir to come to the courts, and sometimes, just sometimes when he had no one to play with, he would ask me to do some routines with him or to play with him. I observed him, watched his every move, did everything that he did, whether technically, physically, in terms of the workout. He would run 10 miles a day, I ran 10 miles a day. He would spend an hour and a half in the gym. I spent an hour and a half in the gym. Gradually, I got better because I was training so hard. And he would play me more and more regularly until after about 6 months living, playing full-time in England, I became his regular training partner, playing with him every day and traveling to tournaments with him. But then injuries started to creep in. Because for me, it was all or nothing. Either I trained like the world champion, or I did nothing. Either the 6 hours a day of hard work that Janshir Khan did, or nothing. Perfect, nothing. But Janshir had been building up for it his entire life for 15 years. For me, it was too sudden a change, and I started getting injuries. Initially, they weren't serious, you know, twisted ankle here and there, knees hurt a bit, 2-3 days off and I would go on the court again. My back started bothering me a little bit, but that didn't stop me. I went back on court, and then the injuries became more persistent, and I had to take a week or two off, but I went back and trained as hard as Janshir did, and the knot in my stomach continued. Every tournament that I played was excruciating. I did feel joy, relief at times, but it was only temporary, ephemeral, once a tournament was over, once a great training session was over. After 18 months playing at that level, my back got so bad, the doctor told me, you have a choice, either to have to be operated on, and that's risky, or to give up playing professional squash. I ended up giving up professional squash. I then went into the army, spent 3 years there, and at the age of 22, came to Harvard. At Harvard, the exact same pattern continued. Before it was with squash, now it was with academics. All or nothing. Either I did all the reading, or I didn't do anything at all, and I chose to do it all. Every single word that was assigned by the professor, I read. The papers had to be perfect. I would read and reread them dozens of times to make sure every comma was in the right place. And I paid a price. Halfway through my sophomore year, I was 23 years old, I'd had enough. I realized that I was in this wonderful place with wonderful students, wonderful teachers, and I was unhappy, with a constant knot in my stomach, constant stress, constant dis-ease. And I said to myself, enough. It was on that day that I decided to change my concentration to psychology. In order to understand, or try to understand, what it is that I was going through. How is it that the external was so amazing, and yet the internal was so radically different? It was then that I became aware that I understood that what I had was perfectionism. This is what we're going to talk about today and in the next class. First of all, what is it? There are many definitions to it. I will present just one definition, the definition that is mostly used in the literature on perfectionism, in the academic literature, because there are a lot of books on the self-help section that you can find on it. I will use the academic definition and the academic approach to it. What are the characteristics of perfectionists? I will share with you some that are treated, that are talked about in the literature. All of them are also ones that I've experienced myself. Then I'll talk about the consequences of perfectionism. What is that price that we pay for being perfectionists? And when I talk about perfectionism, remember that there's a continuum between pursuing excellence and being a perfectionist. No one is perfectly perfectionistic. No one is perfectly pursuing excellence. It's a continuum. We're all somewhere on the continuum. Over the years, I've moved more and more from the perfectionist end toward excellence. Still, I deal with many of these issues that I will share with you. Now, it's not something that just goes away. But what I'll talk about is, once again, how do we shift the pendulum from the perfectionism end to a more perhaps balanced or more toward the pursuing excellence end. One of the reasons many people fear giving up their perfectionism is because they think, well, this is the road to success. I know maybe I'm unhappy, maybe I'm anxious, but I want to be successful, and that is the only way to succeed. No pain, no gain. Well, I will argue through the literature against that and through personal experiences. Then we'll talk about sources of perfectionism for two reasons. First of all, if we understand the source, we're better able to deal with it. And second, if we understand the source, we're less likely to pay it forward. Because very often, when we become parents or teachers, we pay forward the same issues that we have been brought up with. It's hereditary in many ways. Not genetically, but through our behavior, and usually on the subconscious level. So if we understand perfectionism better, its source, we can better stop it right here. And finally, most importantly perhaps, overcoming it. And we're going to talk about that next time. I want to begin by calling on a volunteer. But before anyone volunteers, I want someone who can draw well. Ideally, someone who is a VES concentrator. But if not, anyone who thinks they have a good hand, someone who can draw well. Any volunteer? Remember, courage is not about not having fear. It's about having fear and going ahead anyway. Any volunteers? No, I didn't say volunteer someone else. I said you volunteer. There's a hand? All right, come up. Come up to the stage. Oh, sorry, I didn't say. Any volunteer who would like to come up to the stage? Where is it? Oh, come on. All right. Now, unfortunately, it's not like, you know, the Crocs performance where there is a rope coming from the top, so she'll have to walk down. Good. All right, here she is. All right. Hi. What's your name?
Audrey.
Audrey?
Yeah.
All right. Audrey, I'm going to ask you for something very difficult, very hard. I know you're tired having run from all the way from the top. Here it is. Are you a VES concentrator?
Art history.
Art history. Good enough. All right. What I want you to do here, are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Sure. All right. What sport do you play?
Squash.
Squash. All right. The squash players, I tell you. All right. So do you remember the old squash rackets, not the new ones? They had a very long thin shaft and a round, small round head. Okay, good. So I'd like you to draw here, if you can. You ready for this? A circle. Take your time, no pressure. It's only 850 people watching. A circle. Whoa. That's amazing, I must say. It's round. Yeah. It even starts and ends in the same point. You know, if I had to put a point here, every other point would be the same distance from the middle. It's really remarkable. Well done, well done. All right, I want you to do something else. Now, we do a lot of visualizations in this class, and it's critical, so I want you to visualize for a minute. And what I'd like you to visualize is yourself as a three-year-old drawing a circle. And if you could draw that circle as you drew it, or as you think you drew it when you were 3 years old, right under here. You can take your time, bring yourself back to that era. Already then, you were destined to be an art history concentrator. Okay, now under it, visualize yourself. This may be even more difficult. You know, this is a tough task. Right under here, draw a circle as you think you drew it when you were 1 year old. Worse than that.
Yeah.
Okay. Audrey, you know, the part that I dislike most about teaching, you know what it is? Grading. I hate grading. Yeah, you know, I wish this class wasn't graded. You know, I encourage taking it pass-fail. But even if you were taking it pass-fail, when I look at this, amazing, success, straight A. If, like Princeton, we had A pluses, you would have gotten an A plus. But then, you know, my eyes can't help but look down below this line. This is no circle. I'm sorry to tell you this. I know you're an art history concentrator, I'm a psychology concentrator, but still, you know, we both remember what the squash rackets looked like back then, right? This is no circle. I don't even want to go to this, right? Yeah. No one. This. Sorry. Fail. Even if you were taking this class pass fail. Fail. But this is amazing. This is really remarkable. Now I have a question for you, Audrey. Could you have gotten to this stage, to drawing such beautiful circular circles, without having drawn hundreds and thousands of such failures? Now, could you have gotten to this excellent performance without having failed hundreds or thousands of times? No. Thank you very much, Audrey.
Thanks.
Terrific. So, as you know, psychologists watch people. And I watched you when you came into the classroom today, watched you very closely. And I was amazed. I was blown away. Such talent, such command, such poise. I was watching you, and you know what I saw? You're all phenomenal, great walkers. You walk so well. And you know, I was watching closely, and I saw you. So you had your left leg in front of your right, and you lifted your heel just slightly, so elegantly. And then you lifted the ball of your foot up, just so, you know, and the angle, just the right angle, 33 degrees, you raised it, and then, without even looking, brought it down. Not only that, as you brought it down, your right heel lifted at the same time while your left leg touched the ground. Perfect timing. And then, slightly bent, and you had this look on your face of nonchalance as if you weren't thinking about it. And you lifted your left leg up. Again, your knee bent. And then forward, just, you know what I thought about a breeze and a feather in the breeze? Just throwing your knee forward so elegantly again while lifting your left heel. And then again, you repeated it, the exact same movement, to show me this wasn't lucky, this was planned. I know how to do this, and yes, you do. You're great walkers. But I have a question for you. Could you have become such great walkers without falling hundreds and thousands of times as kids? No way. But you know what? As kids, we know this. So we fall down, maybe we cry if it hurts, but then immediately we get up again. And then we fall down yet again, and we get up. And we smile. And we go on and on and on. You know why? Because we understand. Implicitly, we know it. We have this innate knowledge. We know that there is no other way to learn. Learn to fail or fail to learn. We know this from the time we're born, when we utter words and it just doesn't come out so well. But it's so cute, and we continue and we do it until we learn. We draw many so-called circles until we learn how to draw circles. We fall and get up again, and we know that that is the only way to learn. But we lose that knowledge very early on, once we become self-conscious, once we're able to look at ourselves from the outside, once we're no longer in the experience. Think back to our flow lecture. Once we're no longer in the here and now, we begin to observe, to criticize, and we begin to be afraid to fail. So we don't do well in a paper, and we're devastated. So we ask someone out, and he says no, and we don't ask again. We try out for a play, and we're rejected, and we catastrophize it. I have no talent, I can't act, and we give up. We stop trying, we stop taking risks, we stop coping, and we pay a price. And the price that we pay comes in the form of success in so many areas throughout our lives, and in the form of happiness and self-esteem. Think back to the research on coping and how that ultimately leads to a higher level of self-esteem, to a rise in the baseline. We know these things. In fact, it's ancient wisdom. Here is one example. Chinese character for crisis has two parts. The top, danger. The bottom, opportunity. Yes, it's risky. to take risks. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, everybody hurts sometimes, especially when we fail. But there is no other way to learn, because the other side of failure is opportunity, a learning opportunity. Albert Hubbard, probably the most published writer in history. The greatest mistake a man can make is to be afraid of making one. There's a story about a child who walks around with his grandfather, and he asks the grandfather, "Grandpa, how is it that you're so wise?" "Oh, it's good judgment, my son." "Grandpa, how is it that you have such good judgment?" "Oh, it's through experience, my son." "Grandpa, how is it that you got so much experience?" "Oh, my son, it's through bad judgment." There is no other way. Learn to fail or fail to learn. I want to tell you now a real life story of a failure. This individual started off very energetic, very ambitious, and at the age of 22, lost his job. Barely got a job, he lost it, was fired. At the age of 23, he decided to go for politics. After all, he couldn't hold a job. He was the... Wait and see. Wait and see. He was defeated for state legislature. Then, at the age of 24, he said, "Well, politics is not for me. I'm going to go into business." Failed. Went down. Chapter 11. At the age of 27, nervous breakdown. Couldn't deal with the pressures. Too much. The age of 34, recovered. Energetic again, he ran for Congress, once again was defeated. But he didn't give up and was defeated again at the age of 39. Not a person to be turned down by defeat, to be enervated by it. He ran for Senate. As you can see, what I'm describing here is a true, genuine loser. But he continued, and at the age of 47, he wanted to be nominated but wasn't for vice president. So he tried again, and at the age of 50, he was defeated for Senate. He should have given up at this point. I mean, really, you're 50. An illustrious loser, give up. But he didn't. At the age of 51, he became our 16th president. Learn to fail or fail to learn. Another great leader who changed the world. Gandhi calls his autobiography, "My Experiments with Truth." Why experiments? Because he failed many more times than he succeeded. Experimenting, trying things out. Those who have read his biography or watched the movie know that he first tried his work in South Africa and failed miserably. And then moved from South Africa to India and failed many times until he succeeded. He understands, like Lincoln understands, the importance of success. He says, "Freedom is not worth having if it does not connote freedom to err." And he doesn't just mean political freedom. He means the freedom that we give ourselves. Learn to fail or fail to learn. Common characteristic of all great men and women throughout history. George Eliot, who herself knew a lot of failures, a lot of hardships, Marianne Evans was her name. My favorite author wrote Middlemarch, Daniel Deronda. The important work of moving the world forward does not wait to be done by perfect men. And yet so many people with potential to do great things, to change the world, to make their lives and the lives of others better. So many potentially great people wait and don't act because they're afraid. What if I fail? What will other people say? What will I look like if I fall? What if I don't look perfectly graceful as I walk? But there is no other way, and the successful people recognize this. They understand it. Let me read to you an excerpt from Abraham Maslow. This is not something that you're reading, so I'll read it to you. Quote, "The Greeks called it hubris. It has been called sinful pride, which is, of course, a permanent human problem. The person who says to himself, yes, I will be a great philosopher, and I will rewrite Plato and do it better, must sooner or later be struck dumb by his grandiosity, his arrogance, and especially in his weaker moments will say to himself, who, me? And think of it as a crazy fantasy or even fear it as a delusion. He compares his knowledge of his inner private self with all its weakness, vacillation, and shortcomings, with the bright, shining, perfect, and faultless image he has of Plato. Then, of course, he'll feel presumptuous and grandiose. What he doesn't realize, and he puts this in parentheses, what he doesn't realize is that Plato, introspecting, must have felt just the same way about himself, but went ahead anyway, overriding his doubts about himself. Every great person throughout history had these doubts, feared failing. No one enjoys failure, but also realized that there is no other way to learn. Or I should say re-realized it, because we know it up to a certain age implicitly. Now, Maslow is not saying that arrogance is good. He calls hubris or conceit sinful pride. But what he does say, that in order to avoid this extreme, we have to find, and I quote, a graceful integration between the humility and the pride which is absolutely necessary for creative work. You must be aware not only of the godlike possibilities within, but also of the existential human limitations. In other words, you need to recognize your potential. At the same time, you also need to recognize the inevitability of imperfections. Do you remember the research by Alan Langer? Let me just repeat it quickly for those who don't, since the midterm is long past. The research by Alan Langer that said, where she showed people, highly successful scientists, their actual results, and she asked, how likely are you to get there? And she asked them, how difficult would it be? And they depicted the scientist as superhuman, unattainable. And then she took a second group of people, and she gave them the exact same scientist, the exact same performances, but she also showed them how they got there in the first place. She showed them their failures. She showed them their insecurities, their imperfections, their faults, on the way to the successful attainment of their goal. And what she found was that these students who evaluated the scientists, where their achievement was broken up, evaluated them as human, their achievement as doable, as attainable, no longer as this perfect superhuman individual, even though the exact same results in both cases Why? Because it's difficult for us to imagine the Plato, the Lincoln, the Gandhi, the Anita Roddick from The Body Shop, the Katharine Graham from The Washington Post, Marva Collins, the phenomenal teacher. It's difficult for us to grasp and say, how am I going to be there? Until we realize that they too had their insecurities and fears and imperfections, that they failed many, many times on their way to success. And then it becomes human. This is why I constantly say that the best self-help books out there are biographies. And remember I mentioned Samuel Smiles way back? His self-help book is about biographies of great people, breaking down success, not showing them as the end result, the perfect, faultless picture of a statesman or of a leader, of a successful businesswoman or teacher. Breaking down achievement, then it's attainable. There is no other way to succeed. Let me show you an example of an imperfect, surely imperfect man, but a man who knows his imperfections and decides to go ahead anyway.
That's right, Bennett Brower here with another commentary. Didn't think the suits would have me back, perhaps. Thought they'd have my derriere replaced by one of those cookie-cutter store mannequins. Well, maybe I'm not the norm. I'm not camera-friendly. I don't wear clothes that fit me. I'm not a heartbreaker. I haven't had sex with a woman. I don't know how that works. I guess I don't fall in line. I'm not hygienic. I don't wipe properly. I lack style. I have no charisma or self-esteem. I don't own a toothbrush or let my scabs heal. I can't reach all the parts of my body. When I sleep, I sweat profusely. But I guess the powers that be will keep signing my paycheck, at least until John and Jane Q. Viewer start to go for the remote so they can get back to watching commentators who don't frighten children and don't eat their own dandruff and don't pop their whiteheads with a compass they used in high school. Thank you, Kevin.
Bennett Brower, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Goes ahead anyway. Now, many people know about Babe Ruth's accomplishment, one of the greatest baseball players in history, hit more home runs at the time than anyone else. But how many people know that he also topped his league, was number one in his league five times when it came to strikeouts? More than any other player, the most strikeouts. And you see this correlation. People who hit a lot of home runs get struck out a lot. Or we used to see the greatest of them all. But before Jordan learned how to fly, he had to learn how to walk. And before learning how to walk, he fell many, many times. Yes, even Michael Jordan. How many times did he miss before getting to this high level or high percentage of getting free throws in? Hundreds of thousands of times. Learn to fail or fail to learn. We see this in every area. We spoke about Thomas Edison, the most successful creative scientist, arguably of all time, also the scientist who had failed the most times, failed over 10,000 times before inventing the light bulb. Remember the story. It is no coincidence that the most successful people throughout history are also the people who have failed the most. Explicitly or implicitly, they understand that failure is an opportunity. Anita Roddick, one of her stores, The Body Shop, is just around the corner. Founded The Body Shop, started it in her own backyard, now running an empire. Talks a lot in her book about her failures, miserable failures. Of course they hurt. Of course it hurt Lincoln to fail time and again. But she got up and tried, and now she's running, or used to run. Huge organization, successful organization that does a lot of good. Learn to fail or fail to learn. There's a lot of research showing the importance of recognizing failure as an inevitable part of success. Amy Edmondson, now teaching here at the business school. Those of you who've taken 1508 have heard this before. She did her research with Richard Hackman. And her research, working with Hackman, who does work on teams, was about working in hospitals and identifying the hospitals that use Professor Hackman's conditions for successful teams. So that they have, that they set a clear goal, a clear direction, that they have good support from the outside, and so on. And she looked for groups that fulfill Professor Hackman's requirement for successful teams, and she wanted to show that in hospitals, these teams are indeed more successful. So the measure that she used was failure of these teams. See how many failures they have. So she's working here on the 15th floor right by my office. She's working with Professor Hackman. This was in the 90s when she was working on her dissertation. And then one day she runs into Professor Hackman's office and says, "Eureka, I found it, I have results." She's ecstatic, elated. For years she's been collecting data. And Professor Hackman says to her, "Let me look." And he looks at it, high correlation, and he says, "That's wonderful." And he smiles, and suddenly the smile disappears. And he says, "Are you sure these are the results?" She says, yeah, it is." He said, "Go check it again." So she goes back, a little bit concerned now, runs the statistics again, the exact same results, and she goes back, and she says, "I got the same results. I mean, these are great, very high correlation between the conditions for effective teams and the number of errors that they make." He said, "Yeah, it's a high correlation, but in the wrong direction." In other words, people who fulfilled Richard Hackman's conditions for successful teams actually made more mistakes, it seemed, from the research. They were both baffled, so she went back to the hospital to check what was going on here, what's this phenomenon? And what she found very quickly was the following. Yes, they made more success ostensibly because they reported more mistakes. In effect, they actually made far fewer mistakes, but they reported every mistake that they made. Why? Because they felt safe. They experienced psychological safety with their leader, their manager, that they could report not doing well, that they could report that they erred or had a near miss. And then the organization as a whole, the hospital as a whole, would analyze that mistake, or very often near miss, and learn from it. They failed and they learned from the failure, and as a result, they didn't repeat it. And actual failure rates and fatalities were significantly lower in these hospitals that reported more, but actually failed far less, relative to hospitals that didn't have the psychological safety, where there was no permission to fail, where there was no permission to be human, in other words. And it cost lives. So understanding that failure is part of success is important, not just for the individual level, but for the organizational level as well. The greatest CEOs leaders of all time understand that. There's a story that has become a legend now within IBM. Thomas Watson, the founder, one of his employees, back at the beginning, made a critical marketing mistake, and IBM lost $1 million, which back then was a lot of money, at least for IBM. And he came to Tom Watson. He cared about the organization a great deal. He came to him and handed him a letter. Tom Watson looks at the letter, and it was a letter of resignation. And he says, "What is this?" He said, "I just made a critical mistake. My apologies, and I resign." Watson said, "Why?" He said, "Because, you know, I don't want to put you through the difficult task of firing me." He said, "Fire you? Do you think I'm going to fire you? I've just invested $1 million in your education, and I'm going to fire you?" Jim Burke, CEO of Johnson & Johnson, talks about a very similar experience that he had when he started working for Johnson & Johnson with the founder, General Johnson, where he thought he would be reprimanded for a mistake. Instead, General Johnson called him in and said, "I'm glad you're taking risks. I'm glad you're trying. The fact that you're failing shows me that you have your head right on. But if you make the same mistake again, I'll fire you." Learn from mistakes. Now, these stories, whether they're accurate, you know, these exactly the words that Watson or Johnson used, is beside the point. The point is that they have become legends within the organization, telling people explicitly, don't be afraid of failure as long as you learn from these failures. Thomas Watson, if you want to increase your success rate, double your failure rate. Research by Dean Simonton from UC Davis, one of the founders of the Positive Psychology Network of Scholars. He looked at highly successful scientists and artists throughout history, and what he found was that the most successful artists and scientists throughout history are also the ones who failed the most times. They had the most, in terms of artists, the most, so to speak, duds. Artwork that didn't make it. Why? Because they risked, they tried things. They didn't just keep to the straight and narrow. And they were the most successful over time. They understood it, whether explicitly or implicitly. Learn to fail, or fail to learn. Now, when you come out of this class, when you come out of Harvard, there are not many things I can guarantee, but there is one thing I can guarantee, beyond any doubt. What I can guarantee is that you're going to fail. You're probably going to fail many times. It's inevitable. Even people who try not to, who avoid a lot, still fail. Part of the human condition. But I have two hopes for you in relation to failure. The one hope is that you have a slightly different approach toward failure. Rather than seeing it as a stumbling block, rather than seeing it something to be avoided, rather as seeing it as a catastrophe. Remember David Byrne's work? As a catastrophe, generalizing it, see it as a learning opportunity, as a stepping stone. See it as an inevitable part of success and long-term happiness. So what I hope, my first hope, is that you change your approach, your perception of failure. The second thing that I hope, genuinely hope, I'm not just saying that, because as you know, I only wish the best for you all. The second thing that I hope is that you fail more, that you fail much more. Because you know, if you don't fail a lot, what that means? It means you're not trying to your full capacity. It means you're not taking risks. It means you're not coping. Remember the research on coping. When you don't cope, you compromise on your potential for success, and your potential for happiness. Okay. Now, let's go to the definitions. Let's understand, so what is this perfectionism that we talk about, and how is it related to everything that we've covered thus far? Here is my definition of perfectionism, again, mostly taken from the academic literature with some twist. Perfectionism is an incapacitating fear of failure that permeates our lives, especially those areas that we care about most. Note a couple of things about this definition. An incapacitating fear of failure. Everyone has some fear of failure. No one enjoys it. We all prefer to succeed. But I'm talking about an incapacitating fear of failure that prevents us, that stops us from coping, from trying, from doing things that we really, really want to do because we're afraid of the price that we may pay for doing them. So we conform, so we don't get out of our comfort zone, we don't go to the stretch zone. An incapacitating fear of failure that permeates our lives, especially those areas that we care about most. I saw it significantly in squash. I saw it significantly in my academic work. I saw it throughout the years significantly within my relationships, the areas that I care about most. Let me further explain. It is an approach, a cognitive and emotional schema that we hold toward the journey of our lives, toward the process of getting from point A to point B. Note, there's an emphasis here on the journey. It's not about not having high goals. Today, as I move more from the perfectionism to the excellence, I'm as ambitious, probably more ambitious than I was then. Not in squash, but in other areas. So it's not about giving up the destination. It's about a different approach toward the journey. And that's a significant distinction. It's about the journey from point A to point B. Let's first look at the perfectionist schema, the cognitive schema that a perfectionist has regarding the journey of getting from point A to point B. What's the perfect distance, perfect journey from point A to point B? Straight line. This is the mental schema that the perfectionist has. The person committed to excellence has a different schema. Also, can have the exact same ambitions. Same ambitions, getting from point A, where I am today, to point B. But a person committed to excellence recognizes something different. Yes, this is the general direction, but inevitably, at some point, I'm not going to do so well on a paper or exam, but what can I learn from it? Or inevitably, if I put myself on the line, someone is going to say no, whether it's Rena or anyone else. But I can learn from it and try again. And she may say no again, but I can learn from it, continue growing. And in relationships, the boyfriend, girlfriend, spouse, there are inevitable failures, inevitable disagreements. But then the question is, what do I, as a husband, boyfriend, what do I do? Or what do we do as a couple? Do we learn from that failure and improve our relationship, make it more resilient? And a person committed to excellence understands that there is no other way to get from point A to point B. And he or she continues failing 5, 10, 5,000, or 10,000 times until they make the unrealistic expectations realistic, Remember from the beliefs of self-fulfilling prophecy lecture. Now the question is, which one is realistic? Which schema addresses the human condition, the perfectionist or the excellence? And the answer is obvious. There is no perfect journey from point A to point B. And when we don't conform to reality, we pay a price. And the price comes inevitably in the form of frustration, unhappiness, an incapacitating fear, and a compromise on our success and our happiness, as I will argue. Now, there isn't a perfect perfectionist. And now when I'm going to talk about the characteristics of one versus the other, no one is all the way to one side or the other. I'm sure most people will find at least some of these characteristics applicable, but remember, it's a continuum. I simplified it and I made it into a binary distinction. It's not in reality. Nothing is, or very rarely is something that. Let me go over some of the characteristics. These are the characteristics taken from the literature, and every single characteristic is a characteristic that I experienced myself. But in your readings, there are also others that you may connect to better. So let's begin. First of all, defensiveness. This is something that I experienced to a great extent, especially within my relationships, the important relationships. Why defensiveness? Because there's a very clear schema in the perfectionist mind, and every criticism or disagreement suggests a deviation from the straight and narrow. And remember, we don't like inconsistency between our internal schema, between what is inside and what is outside the world. We like them to be congruent, otherwise we experience dissonance. So it's immediately pushing back and fighting back, avoiding this defensiveness. A person committed to excellence is open to suggestions, realizing that there is no other way to improve. A perfectionist is obsessed with failure, obsessed with the deviation from the straight line, and therefore focuses on the deviations, on the half empty, versus a person committed to excellence, not that he or she ignores the failures, but learns to focus on strengths, learns to focus on the positive, doesn't take the positive for granted. Going back to our question of focus lectures. Perfectionists overgeneralize. It's all or nothing. Either I am a complete success or I'm a complete failure. Person committed to excellence is realistic. Understands that there are ups and downs and they're natural. A perfectionist doesn't accept him or herself. There is self-rejection. Why? Because in order to accept him or herself, there has to be congruence between the schema and the performance, and there never is. A person committed to excellence has unconditional acceptance. Unconditional acceptance in which sense? For the person. Not always enjoying failures naturally, but understanding that it's an inevitable part of the process. The journey, a straight line, is static. There is one way, and that's the highway. Versus much more flexibility, much more meandering, much more exploring, much more trying things out. Perfectionist, remember, we don't like when there is a disconnect with the schema. Severe fear of failure. Compared to person committed to excellence, perceives failure as feedback. What can I learn? What can I learn from my failures? What can I learn from what just happened? And finally, the perfectionist, the journey is just a means toward the end. The most important thing is getting there. A person committed to excellence focuses on the journey as much, if not more, than the destination. So these are some of the characteristics. Again, you may connect to some more than others. Let's look at some of the consequences of being a perfectionist versus being a person committed to excellence. How does this play out in people's lives? Again, these are all examples from the literature, as well as examples of things that I've experienced myself, and to some extent still experience. The perfectionist experiences temporary relief. Why? Because the pressure mounts on immediately right after I achieve point B and there is a point C, and then the pressure is to adhere to this perfect straight line. The stress, the knot in the stomach, or wherever it is for different people, returns after a short period of relief. The perfectionist is also the consummate rat racer. What does a rat racer's life look like? Let me give you an example. The rat racer, the perfectionist, from a very young age, again, it very often comes from other people, significant adults, but not always. Very often, we generate it ourselves because of our culture, and we'll talk about the cultural forces that lead us to that. So that person, the perfectionist, is in elementary school and already feeling the pressure to get into a good high school. They work hard, but that's that they can handle, but what's difficult for them is the knot. What's difficult for them is the pressure, but they say to themselves, I'm going to work hard now, I'm going to be under pressure until I get into the high school of my dreams, and then I'll be able to relax. And that's what he or she is often told by other people. Just work hard now, it's worth it, because you'll get into this high school. They work hard and they get into their top high school, and they're elated, they're so happy. For about 2 weeks, and they start studying in their high school, and the pressure mounts on again. And then they're under pressure to do a lot of extracurriculars, because you know what? You need those extracurriculars to get into a top college. You need to be president of 3 organizations. You need to be on 2 varsities. You need to get a Nobel Prize in order to get. And it's actually remarkable. I was a business tutor here, and your resumes are amazing. And it's getting more and more so every year, more and more pressure. But that person is experiencing the stress in high school, but they say, well, I'll just experience the stress until I get into my top college, because this is really my dream. I want to get there. So the rat race continues running and running and running, literally and metaphorically, to get to the next stage, applying to the top colleges. The resume is amazing. The scores are amazing. And April 1 comes, and there's an envelope. And you open up the envelope. You open it up, and what you see, you got in to your dream school, and you're ecstatic, you're elated. And between April 1 and September 17th, there is elation, the best period of your life, stress-free, relief. I made it, now I can really relax. But as we talked about before, right after freshman week, we go back to the same pattern. The perfectionist pattern. Again, the stress, the difficulties, getting the resume, because when you look for a job, they're not going to be that interested in what you did in high school. So again, building the resume, working hard, stressful, difficult for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. And yes, there are times that are good, times of relief, but they're short-lived, because then there is another exam around the corner, then there is another paper waiting to be done. But it's only temporary, the stress, because once I get my top job, then I'll really be happy. And you apply, and you get your dream job, and you're ecstatic. Senior spring is wonderful, not just because you're taking positive psychology, not just because you're almost done. It's because you don't care. You've already got your job. You don't care about getting that extra resume addition. You don't care about getting that extra top grade. You're happy. And you start the job, and initially it's wonderful for about a week, and then the pressure mounts. And you realize that if you want to really make it in your job, you have to put in the hours, and not just the hours, you have to put your heart and soul into that work. But you say to yourself after a while, and people say to you, well, it's just temporary, it's the 2-year program. And then you can go to business school of your choice. And you go to the business school of your choice, and initially it's great, but then you start to think about the next stage. Because it's not enough for you to remain an analyst, you become an associate. And after that, you're stressed again until finally you make it and you become a partner. You buy a huge house, beautiful car. On a Sunday, you get out in your Mercedes convertible and you drive in your neighborhood, roof down, feeling elated. You've made it. You wave to your neighbors who are driving in their convertible Ferrari in your neighborhood. But then instead of turning around, you continue going to your office because you have work to do, because you want the next promotion. And you say to yourself, once I get that next promotion, then I would have made it. Then I will be happy. Then there will no longer be this stress. And you get the next promotion. This time, you truly feel on top of the world. You become the managing director of this large organization. A hero. And you sit down on your chair, a little bit different from this one. You sit down and you lie back, you put your legs up this way, and you think to yourself, I did it. You look outside the window, you see Central Park way down in the distance. See the people there, the cars driving, the taxis. You look around, huge office. And finally, you feel happy. And then there is a knock on the door. You put your legs down. After all, you have to maintain a certain demeanor. You put your legs down. You say, come in. And the door opens, and it's your chairman, the chairman of the board. You say hi, and she says hi back. And then she says to you, you're terrific. You're awesome. You have done so much. You have done so much for this organization. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. But it's time to retire. You're 72 years old. This caricature is the life of the rat racer. The rat racer who postpones joy, who postpones enjoyment to later life. I gave a specific one to business, but this applies to any area. You could be a doctor, you could be a lawyer, you could be working for not-for-profits for your entire life. You could be working for the Order of Mother Teresa. It applies to anyone because it's an approach, it's an internal approach to the things that we do with our lives. Some of you may have noticed that I just ran out of batteries. And what you don't know, but what I'm going to tell you, is that I forgot the power plug at home. And what is very interesting is that every time, and I kid you not, it happened last year, every time when I teach perfectionism, something goes wrong. Last year, I actually forgot my computer at home. Very strange. But I'm going to continue anyway. I'm going to get up and walk to the board and continue this the old-fashioned way. So a person committed to excellence doesn't learn to enjoy the process, doesn't learn to enjoy the here and now. It's always about getting there, about getting to point B. And at point B, there is some relief, but it's only temporary. And then again, the next goal, and the next one, and the next one. Why postpone happiness? Why postpone joy? Why postpone our potential to pension age? This doesn't mean that there are no hardships for a person committed to excellence. A person committed to excellence, instead of experiencing temporary relief, enjoys lasting success because he or she also knows how to enjoy the process. This can apply whether you're an investment banker or a monk. Remember what I've said time and again, the issue is not the kind of work that you choose. It's the reason you choose it. It's your approach toward the journey. It's much more about internal. If investment banking or consulting is what does it for you, if it makes you happy in the long run, again, doesn't mean that you won't work hard and, you know, wish you had worked 80 hours a week instead of 90. Yeah, go through the hardship. But if you're there for the right reasons, you can lead a happy life, a good life, and a life that will contribute to the betterment of the world. A person who goes into the Order of Mother Teresa for the wrong reasons can be a perfectionist, is less likely to be happy, and I would say could contribute to the world in more different and meaningful ways if he or she had chosen it for the right reasons. So I'm not just talking about the rat race in one area, it applies to every area. Another characteristic of a person or a consequence of perfectionism is that for a perfectionist, there is inevitable failure. I haven't met a perfect person. I haven't met a person who has gotten to be successful without having failed many times, or will be successful in the future without failing. There's inevitable failure. For a person committed to excellence, there is potential for success at every step of the way. Even when he or she falls, it's a learning opportunity. We're going to talk about many of the consequences next time, but I just want to end with one thing. One of the central concepts to this class is self-esteem. Think about the self-esteem of a perfectionist versus the self-esteem of a person committed to excellence. The perfectionist pays a very high price in terms of his or her self-esteem. Why? Because if there is inevitable failure, and there is always failure, and each time when there is a deviation from the straight line, there is a lack of acceptance for oneself, telling oneself, I'm a failure, I'm no good. And if we hear this over and over again, of course it's going to influence our self-esteem over time. Nathaniel Brandon, what is the first pillar of self-esteem? Self-acceptance. A person committed to excellence accepts him or herself. Another reason for lowered self-esteem with perfectionism. And finally, the issue of coping. The issue of coping, of putting ourselves on the line. Daryl Bems, we talked about this self-perception theory. We derive conclusions about ourselves by the way we see ourselves behaving. So if I see myself avoiding taking risks, not going up to someone and asking her out, or not trying out for a play, or not going for the thing that I really, really, really want to do with my life. If I see myself behaving this way, what conclusions will I derive about myself? Not willing to take risks. Oh, probably not that courageous. Not willing to stand up for him or herself. Despite the difficulties, despite the pain that often comes with failure or with doing what we really, really want to be doing with our lives. Contrast this with a person who takes risks, with a person who does fail, with a person who does cope. Yes, there will be ups and downs, and probably more ups and downs, but it won't look like this, which are the normal ups and downs, where the base level stays the same. It will be ups and downs toward being happier, more fulfilled, and more successful, because there is no other way to fulfilling our potential. I'll see you next time.